have this like dumb song in my head because I discovered my favorite new satellite radio station, Pop 2K.
Pop 2K.
Must have been love, but it's over
and
now.
And let's hit the music. Come on. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
That's the way it goes. Come on. You guys know what's
happening. And welcome to another episode of Make Me Smart, the show where we connect the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture, and you discover Kai's inner sigh.
Also, can I just
week
say,
after week.
Can I just say, I mean, I know we're putting this on YouTube now and everything so that we can do a little video with the radio, but I've got like lights in my face, and TV just is terrible.
Aww, I know, me too.
I know.
Like, also, what? I couldn't find my hipster safety glasses clear readers today, and so I'm wearing my other hipster glasses, which are like the dark frame kind. I'm literally looking at myself right now. This is the danger of doing video. Like, does it look okay?
Oh, I can't even see myself. I have to wait till it's all done.
Holy cow. It's very distracting. It's for the better, really. Hey, you can watch us on YouTube now, guys.
Oh, by the way,
you don't know what the heck
APM,
we're talking
about. Subscribe. Anyway, back to the intended purpose of this broadcast, this little thing we do called Make Me Smart. None of us is as smart as all of us, as you know.
That is correct.
Because we say it all the time.
And today on the show, we are going to talk about, we're just like delving right into my favorite areas. We're going to talk about tech IPOs, specifically businesses whose models are built on waves and waves of the gig economy,
right?
Freelance workers and independent contractors. So Lyft, of course, recently filed, and it is part of this wave of tech IPOs that include Uber, Postmates, and Airbnb, not for nothing, also Slack and Pinterest and several others. But a lot of them, right? A lot of these companies are gig economy companies. And frankly, have a business model that relies on labor issues that aren't quite settled. Lyft has 1,600 full-time employees, but it relies on 1.4 million drivers who have no healthcare, no sick days, no overtime. They're all independent contractors on some level. They earn about $17.50 an hour. And even though they're organizing in some way, and there are these protests and things, as non-employees, they don't have a federal right to form a union.
So here's why we're talking about this. These companies now are increasingly going to the capital markets, right? Lyft just filed for its initial public offering and has actually gone public on the markets. Uber filed its paperwork the other day. It, too, will, in substantially greater dollar amounts, be a public company reasonably soon. There are more coming. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about that phenomenon. These gig economy companies now becoming an entrenched part, really, of American capitalist democracy, if I might just state it a little bit grandly.
Everyday people are now going to be, you know, your pension fund, your 401k, like you're now going to be an investor in some form.
Yeah.
In these, and that's why I think, you know, like to answer the why should I care question,
because you
all of you are now becoming investors in what is essentially an entirely new model for labor in this country. So it seemed worth getting smarter about.
It seems apt. Anyway, Kristen Sharp is the executive director of the Shift Commission at New America. It's a nonpartisan think tank, New America is. The Shift Commission is one of their projects that focuses on the future of work. And we got her on the phone and we're going to talk about this for a while. Kristen, how are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, you bet. Let's test the premise here, right? That we now all, through our pension funds and other investments we might have and participation in the markets, we now are sort of invested in these companies in a moral and financial sense. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that the IPOs of this kind of company shows is that this kind of company is here to stay. It came into the economy originally as sort of an experimental model, testing out something new and a new way of doing things using digital platforms, both for consumers to be able to sort of use products in a different way, and also for workers to be able to think through new income sources and new options for income. And I think that the fact that this is becoming sort of part of the landscape means that we have to figure out new systems for dealing with both the way we work and sort of the ways we support workers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess fundamentally, if a bunch of these companies go public and they're successful, Are we creating a permanent gig worker class? I mean, are we really changing labor in this country?
You know, I think in some ways labor in this country is already changing and was well before we had the gig economy or freelance work. There were trends way before digital platforms exacerbated them that showed the workforce fragmenting a little bit and more sort of bite-sized contingent parts of the economy getting broken off in different ways. So digital platforms, I think, have both advantages and strengths for workers and disadvantages, and they're being used accordingly. There are lots of instances where workers who have an anchor job, who have some other kind of source of income, use these as transition points and use digital platforms to sort of increase their income, create new ways of having income, support them while they're trying to do something else. And the thing that we've got to do is make sure that, one, people still have the opportunity to use them as a source of economic mobility and a sort of launch point for other things. And two, that we don't end up with a permanent sort of professional class of workers versus service class of workers. We still want things to be fluid between those two kinds of workers.
Okay, so look, I take your point about these, and I'm going to use pejorative, or a phrase that is becoming a pejorative word, but let's roll with it. So workers who have a job but maybe want to transition to something else can use these gig economy jobs as sort of a side hustle to move where they want to be in this economy and in this workforce. But doesn't that sort of say that the full-time jobs that people have now simply are not enough to get by in this economy, and we're enabling that?
Well, I mean, in some ways, yeah, I think that's true. But this kind of work is here, and it's tech-enabled. Digitally enabled by the platforms themselves. I don't know that supporting it or using those things as a consumer or not is driving it as much as the fact that it's there, it's an option, and people are using it. So because of that, we need to make sure that we're putting in place the kinds of supports that allow that to be a good thing rather than a bad thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this question, though, of how these workers are classified is still a little bit unsettled, right? What is that going to look like going forward?
Flux.
Because it certainly is not, everybody's fine with it. You know, the workers are, the drivers are cool with their classification and or their status. I mean, what is this transition going to look like in terms of getting to the good?
You mean, Molly, the whole contractor versus full-time employee and all that jazz stuff, right?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. And who provides benefits and who should and what support the companies. Yeah. But specifically that legal question of, are they independent contractors or are they employees? Even that's not settled, right?
Yeah, that's still a little bit in flux, and there are pending court cases that are looking at that. I think that what research is starting to show a little bit is that workers who depend on the gig economy or freelance work entirely don't love it. And for those kinds of workers, it's even more crucial to think about what are the kinds of structural support that we have to put in place as the economy is adapting and changing. People who are using it, like I said, as a launch point really do like it and really are sort of enthusiastic about a ready source of additional income that you don't have to go through additional training for, that you don't have to take classes for, that you don't have to sort of, you don't have a long time for a runway to get onto.
So let me back you up for a minute. What kinds of structural supports do we need as the workforce changes?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think we need everything from the actual physical infrastructure, you know, making sure that everybody has broadband and digital literacy so that they are aware that these platforms are out there and that they're usable and that we make them usable for lots of different people. Then we need to restructure our ed system a little bit, our education system, so that we're infusing in a little bit more sense of entrepreneurialism and a little bit more sense that, like, teaching people the skills to put different pieces of things together. And then beyond that, we need sort of other options besides just gig economy for new emerging work for people. And we need to make that more clear and visible so that people know that, you know, what kinds of things are out there as anchor jobs that you build on with a side hustle.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
man, this anchor jobs something that I feel like I could spend. The idea that that's the new reality is that we have to work toward an anchor job and then a bunch of other things that sort of tie it all together is fascinating. But I mean, so you're really talking about, though, the transition toward this future in which work has profoundly changed. And clearly it already is. But backing up to the now, where's the safety net come from if you don't have the anchor job? Talking about those people who, you know, like in the Bay Area where the streets are clogged with delivery people, you know, would-be gig economy workers are finding that the pay is terrible because there's 50 million people driving for DoorDash and doing Uber Eats. And then on top of that, there's this question of like where the benefits come from. And in fact, as we started to record this show, I got a pitch from a private company that's looking to aggregate worker benefits. Like, is that what the future looks like?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're in a lot of ways, there are a bunch of different companies right now that are looking at ways to aggregate benefits, and particularly looking at ways to have multiple sources of income contribute to a portable benefit system that allows people to have more than one source paying into that, so you're not as dependent on an anchor job. I think that we certainly will need to sort of think through that on a much more widespread basis, thinking about either the option of having everything be on the independent market and have, you know, have sort of readier access to what the different options are and sort of a better process for explaining to people what the options are and what they can buy, or something that's more like an adapted version of the ACA and healthcare so that there's a platform where you're able to have all of your benefits that follow you as the person rather than stick with your job.
So I'm glad you mentioned the ACA because my next question was going to be, where is this infrastructure going to come from, right? Where are the rules and the regulations and the ways of doing it going to come from? Is it going to be government setting this up, or is it going to be, as Molly alluded to, third-party companies saying, hey, I've got this for-profit solution to a gig economy problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think we know that right now. I mean, right now, the reason that there are private for-profit companies exploring this is because we don't have a government system that sets that up, you know? Yeah. But given the fact that our political system is somewhat fractured right now, and...
it is, ladies and gentlemen, the understatement of the day.
And that there's some gridlock in terms of coming to an agreement, even if we were all clear on what that agreement should look like. I think that it's going to be a little while before we're able to get to a point where that would be government structured.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I should back up a second. I realized that we had a whole talk about aggregating worker benefits, and we didn't sort of explain what that's going to look like. And I guess that's part of the question, but are these private companies essentially saying, we'll create a pool, almost like an insurance pool, or you can subscribe to health insurance through this company? Like, what are some of the models that you guys are seeing for figuring out what that could look like for people who are independent contractors?
Yeah, so it's taking a couple different kinds of forms right now. So the platform companies themselves often cannot legally provide actual benefits right now for workers that are not classified as full-time employees. Or traditional W-2 employees. So they usually direct people to the resources that they can use to sort of easily figure out how to buy insurance on the private market or set up a 401k or you know, get disability insurance or those kinds of things. So one thing is platform companies looking at how to connect people with existing resources. Then there's a second set of companies that are sort of from scratch or sometimes as part of the insurance companies looking at how to create insurance products for people who are working in the freelance world, and not just gig economy freelance. That's digitally enabled platforms. The freelance world also includes people who are lawyers, who are contractors and graphic designers, and people who, you know, are selling a skill in some way that isn't gig economy related.
So as all of these structures get built up around this gig economy that is really, for as long as we've been dealing with it now, for 5 years or whatever, as long as Uber's been around or maybe longer, as these structures get built up, And we begin to codify some of this. Is the underlying structure sustainable? And I know you say it's basically, it's here, deal with it, but is it sustainable in a sense of having a diversified economy where everybody prospers and there's a solid middle class and all of those economic tropes that you heard for decades from politicians?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the key thing is that anything related to technology people ultimately have control over. Like, we set up the systems, the political systems, the, you know, advocacy systems, the things that allow people to demand those kinds of structures and benefits. And I think we need to get to the point where we have a way to do that and advocate for those things. But I do think that this is sort of which is not at all to say that there aren't downsides to an economy where more things are more volatile and more in flux. But there are also upsides to those things. And it's sort of up to industry leaders, political leaders, worker advocacy leaders, and others to identify the things that will make that a good world and not a bad world, and then advocate for those things.
Okay, so wait. So are you hopeful about that, given the gridlock that we were talking about a minute ago? I mean, the Congress of the United States can't find its backside with both hands.
Say, you said that, not me.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I've said it on the radio, too. So, yeah, I mean, you know. Right?
Yeah, no, it's true. But a lot of things are bubbling up from other places. Like, this doesn't have to be led from the top down from the federal government. This can also be ideas that are coming up in individual cities, ideas that are coming up in individual states, ideas that are coming from the private sector and then sort of spreading around. So I hope that we end up with a little bit more diverse of an approach than just Congress saying we got to do something and doing that. Because you're right. I don't think we're there right now.
Right.
Right. And I guess to sort of end at the beginning, is there a possibility that because these companies are now going public, because we will be invested in them on some level, because the protests will probably get louder, the issues will be more available in SEC filings, is that going to force some of these issues?
Yeah, I think so. And I think partly the consumers can force some of those issues, partly the workers themselves. I mean, these platform companies that are tech-driven companies can't get, you know, engineers and data analysts and things to do the work if they feel like they're truly doing bad things to the economy. Like, there's often, and particularly in the millennial generation and down, there's often sort of a mission-driven sense of wanting to do work that has a purpose. And so I think that will have some impact as well. And then the rest of us, you know, thinking about how to make adaptability and the ability to put things together in a new way and be constantly learning, like, that's just the hallmark of the economy and the, you know, the world we're in right now.
Kristen Sharp, she's the executive director of the Shift Commission at New America, focusing on the future of work. Kristen, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. Appreciated talking to you.
See you.
Take care.
Be good. So there you go. What do you think? If you are a gig economy worker, let us know. Let us know what you think
Email
of that
us.
Whole deal. Yeah.
One thing, you know, one thing we didn't even touch on, too, is that there's also some of these drivers, some of the gig economy people in the Lyft IPO got, you know, bonuses and but they added up to like less than a dime per ride. I mean, there's just sort of all of these interesting questions about, I don't know, how these workers are going to benefit, and we'd like to know more.
Yeah, and also, if you are a gig economy worker that is not driving or delivering something, I just to get a sense of the scope of the gig economy out there, right? So Uber is great, but if you drive for Uber, we're not talking about that, right? Other people out there in the gig economy, just so I can like personally expand my horizons. I think that would be interesting.
Also, if you have an anchor job and a side hustle, which I guess is like everyone, arguably, but anchor job.
That was a new phrase for me. And it's a little bit not encouraging, because if that becomes part of the lexicon, right? Hey, what's your anchor job? And then what's your side hustle? Instead of what do you do at a dinner party, it's what's your anchor job, yo?
I know. I have questions. Yeah. I have questions, and I know you do too. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo. And
that's better.
FYI, depending on when you're listening to this, currently it is Tuesday the 16th. You already filed your taxes, so you know what you're capable of
you got
giving
lots
now.
Of money left. Oh no, just kidding.
Tomorrow is the last day of our Make Me Smart specific fundraiser, which means swag.
Schwag. It does mean schwag. So here's what we've got. We've got a sticker, a cool Make Me Smart sticker, which we showed you last week, actually, which you get for any amount. Molly Wood, I'm reasonably sure, has covered her entire laptop with them, right?
I'm actually trying to get my laptop and unplug it so I can hold it up to the camera so that if you're watching us on YouTube,
there
you can see it.
There you go.
The imperfectness of my grid.
Yeah. So those notebooks are still available. Molly, you have one there? I don't have one there. But anyway,
they didn't give me one. Are you kidding?
Is that right?
They are fancy.
No, you were here last week. I saw you with one. Did you not take that home with you?
Yeah. No, that was the one I got to touch for like 20 minutes tops to do a little video. And then they were like, give it back. It's a really nice notebook, you guys.
Yes.
It's nice.
Stephanie Patterson, our fundraising person, would yell at me if I didn't now give you the URL, which is the name of the game here. Marketplace.org/donate. I don't care if it's $5. I don't care if it's $50. Actually, I care more if it's $50, but, you know, we'll still take your emails.
It could be a dollar.
Just look, we're a nonprofit news organization here at Marketplace, and we absolutely, just like we can't do the show and its contents without you, we cannot physically run this place without you. So help us out. Hook us up.
That is very true.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we're back, fixation time.
Okay. Hello. We're back.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Oh,
how
didn't
are
see you there.
Just thought I'd try something different this time. It's the low energy re-stab is what it is.
It was chill. It was like, friendly.
That's,
it was
personal. That's me. I'm very chill.
That's so chill.
Because that's me. If you know me, you know how chill I am.
If you're watching on YouTube right now, you can see me shaking my head dramatically.
Yes.
Video
also,
is fun,
by the way,
you guys.
I have a hole in the elbow of this sweater. So if you're looking at my video feed, don't look at my elbows.
Embarrassing.
Anyway, so you want to go first? What do you want to do? You've got
five things in here.
Good
I know. It's either
pick one.
It's all or nothing. I'm a feast or famine kind of person. All right. It's all or nothing.
Go.
You know what it's so funny because I put a bunch of stuff in here, but you know what I'm really fixated on? And this is so nerdy, but I want a folding phone.
Oh, shut up.
I'm into the folding phone.
Seriously?
I'm just in a nerd out. I'm just going
to
have an actual nerd moment for a moment.
I'm not.
Because
notes from the Samsung Galaxy
these like
day one.
Right. Yes. Okay. You know, like phones have not evolved in 10 years.
All right. So
smartphones have not evolved.
Yeah. Sorry. We have to describe this thing. So it's an article in TechCrunch. It's called the Samsung Galaxy Fold. And instead of being a flip phone and flipping up vertically, it folds like a book.
Right, but the screen folds. There is not a hinge
in
the middle of this thing. It's not like a flip phone and then a keyboard comes down. Now, it was announced several weeks ago. It was announced at Mobile World Congress, or actually before. There was a big Samsung event in February, and they announced this thing.
$2,000! $2,000! Sorry,
right, $2,000. That's what I was about to say.
Okay,
and everybody was like, I can't believe this thing costs $2,000. That's crazy. And I was like, it is a brand new piece of technology that has never... I think I just accidentally did a Kai impression that I did.
And the best part was the guy.
I'm not talking about you.
Was you going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. That was the guy.
Oh my God, $2,000.
I'm a manly radio guy. It's, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Anyway.
I'm just saying that 1 minute when you said $2,000 was pretty.
All right,
up a notch.
So number one, why do you want this? And number two, honestly, give me your veteran tech journalist. Why does it matter?
I mean, I think it matters because we have not seen a lot of innovation in this space. Like the smartphone, it's sort of boring. Like at this point, you get a new phone, maybe you've got better battery life, and maybe the screen's like a little nicer, but let's be honest, you can't really tell the difference. And is the camera better? Okay. And it's just not that exciting. And so what I think is pretty cool about this is that it's an actual neat innovation that could also be useful, that just moves things forward just a tiny bit in this otherwise boring consumer electronic space. Do I think this is like an earth-shattering development in the world of technology? No, but they made a freaking actual phone screen that folds and opens seamlessly and then is a tablet. Like, boom. Like, you open it up and the screen, you can't, there's no, I mean, that's objectively cool.
Yes, and I totally point granted, and I know you didn't mean this way, but it's interesting to hear you say about a device that's only been around for 10 years and contains more computing power than the rockets that went to the moon. You called it a boring space. And look, you're not wrong, right? Because it's all some variation of more pixels, bigger screen, whatever. Oh, there I did it again.
Yep.
yeah.
Yeah, you went up high again, too.
I know.
I'm just saying.
I know.
So, you know what? Like, it's not often that I geek out about a gadget anymore. Yeah. And I'm not even talking about the price because, look, this is a brand new, you know, this is an early adopter price. That's fine. But I just, I was like, you know what? Good job.
Right.
Some tech happened and it was kind of neat-ski.
Totally.
The end.
Neat-ski. No, that was cool. No, I'll give you that because I had not seen that.
It's fun.
And nor had I seen the price. All right.
Awesome.
Mine is way less appealing or surprising or interesting, but I'm going to do 30 seconds on the Federal Reserve System of the United States and Donald Trump, the President of the United States of America. You have heard, of course, that the president wants to appoint Herman Cain of Godfather's Pizza fame and also 999 from the 2012 campaign, and Stephen Moore, an often incorrect economic analyst and pundit on many a cable news show, to the Federal Reserve Board. Turns out they're going to back out of that. The White House now is saying,
oh, what?
We are talking to
candidates
to replace Cain or Moore for the Fed. Look, that's actually a good sign, right? And it's good that Republicans in Congress came out and said this is a terrible idea. It's good that the White House is well, let me rephrase that. It's good that there are signs from the White House that the president is going to reconsider this, because that would be just an epic mistake. But I just want to get that on the record, that that's a good thing that the White House is perhaps seeing the light. That's all.
That's true.
That's all.
You're right.
That's all.
It's good that there are limits on
preparedness
for things.
Yes. All right.
The end.
The end.
Okay.
Moving on.
Moving on. It's your turn.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen, brother.
Can I just jump in real quick and say it's been almost 1 year since since our GDPRD party.
Wow.
Our GD party.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy, right?
Yeah, totally.
Time passes. Can't stop it. All right. 2 weeks ago, we asked how the tax law has affected us. Just today, actually, I was looking at my child and I was like, can I just have the time slow down machine? Because why is he such a teenager? 2 weeks ago, we asked you how the tax law has affected you. And oh, my goodness, you had thoughts. And all the thoughts were different. Like, there were so many varied answers. Megan Pope from Michigan is a self-employed private music teacher, and she and her husband recently had a baby.
Yay.
She sent us this voice memo on how expanding their family, congratulations, changed their taxes.
With the new tax law and the increase in our household size to 3, our tax refund this year was more than double what it usually is. I know I shouldn't give the government an interest-free loan, but when you're figuring out your own taxes as a self-employed worker and dealing with a newborn, something's got to give.
Yeah, yes, it does.
Yeah.
Man, nap when they
so
nap.
So I'm glad it was.
Yeah, no, look.
The child tax credit thing is,
that's exactly right.
No
it's
joke.
It's the expansion of the child tax credit. And look, when you're juggling a newborn, man, all bets are off. Totally.
We should
totally,
do a show on birth rate. I think the birth rate stuff is really interesting. Yeah, just, you know, like declining birth rate, which is a thing.
And honestly, and then, what it means, right? Because it's a huge macroeconomic issue, not to get all marketplace.
Like what it means and then why there's such a huge, you know, literal financial incentive and always has been some financial incentive for people to have babies.
Yep.
But this one is a really specific one. Anyway, story idea. Hope somebody was writing that down.
Write it down in the control room. Stacey Cronach is a retired tax attorney in Erie, Pennsylvania. I've been there a couple of times. Lovely place. She knows a lot about taxes, from her work over the years, and sent us this voice memo about who might be getting a bigger refund this year.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
Hi, Stacey.
If you're lucky enough to have most of your income be in the form of interest, dividends, and capital gains and losses, you experienced a huge drop in your tax liability. I'm talking like paying maybe 10% of what you paid the prior year. So some people are really experiencing a big tax refund. Just thought you should know. Thank
right.
you.
So love let's think about
who does she mean? Yeah.
Well,
help.
It's all about the sources of income, right? And if you are a worker and you get your wages, that is a different category of income than interest, dividends, and capital gains and losses, which is to say, in a very Bernie Sanders-esque way of saying this, the owners of capital are benefiting more from this tax bill than the laborers and producers.
So this is if you're... I mean, this sounds to me like if you're a business, but also like
rich people.
If you're a rich person who turns your money into more money via the stock market,
right?
And then you get interest dividends.
Right.
If all your stuff is a 1099 div,
ooh, get a load.
Then
of that. Yes,
you. Right. I bank at Schwab. There's always all this gobbledygook up in the corner. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but
yes, that's exactly what it is, right? If you are in the investing class, you benefit from this tax
bill. No help at all.
And if you are in the working class, you benefit less.
Man.
Yeah.
But
look, we knew that going in.
We did, but thanks for like really laying it out, Stacey, because, lucky you, people who turn your money into more money. Stefano. I'm going to go with Stefano because it's like Days of Our Lives, the villain.
What?
Stefano.
I was a general guy, actually.
Some people are going to email us.
Anybody remember Luke and Laura?
Stefano. Of course. Right?
Just checking.
Man, we are aging ourselves right now. Stefano, the bad guy from Inglewood, California, sent us his taxes take.
Last year, we got back enough to pay for almost for our property taxes due in April. This year, we owe twice as much.
Yeah. Inglewood, California.
Simple.
Right?
And yet painful, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Inglewood, California. It is a dart.
It's all about the state and local tax deductions and how they were largely limited and worked out not to the benefit of a lot of blue state Americans. That's representative democracy at work.
I would argue that it's a semi-representative democracy.
Elections.
This is why, though. This is why the governor of New York referred to this tax bill specifically as what class income warfare aimed at blue states. I mean, you could say elections have consequences, but I don't think everybody expected the election consequence to be punishment of the people who voted otherwise.
Then people weren't paying attention.
Carefully. so dark.
If I were producing the show, I would hit the sting right now. That's all I'm saying.
I would also hit the sting.
There we go.
Freaking dark.
All right, shall we move on from there, please? Shall we? I didn't even mean to go there, but, you know. Anyway, make me smart question time. What is something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? Chan Liu sent us his answer in this voice memo.
As a refugee immigrant, I grew up poor and was often drilled into me that getting an education and working hard was what we had to do to get ahead in life. At some point around the second or third grade, my mom bought me a bundle of T-shirts from the swap meet. One of the T-shirts had this phrase printed across the front. It doesn't matter what you know, but rather who you know. After all, who cares about what you know anyways? I was always turned off by this because it flew in the face of the meritocracy I was raised to believe in. It wasn't until I got much older that I realized that there was more wisdom on that T-shirt than I could have appreciated at the time. I grew to learn the harsh reality in life that being smart and knowing things is necessary, but oftentimes not sufficient. And while some relationships can be transactional, a healthy network of friends, coworkers, and acquaintances is vital for long-term success.
Well.
That's great. That's so awesome.
That was great.
There is so much wisdom. There is so much wisdom in the Make Me Smart answers. They are amazing. Yeah. They are amazing. I will say that I know I'm just going to continue to age myself on this show, but I feel like the older you get in life, the more you notice that, because you start to realize, like, life is long and I've known this person for a long time and we've sort of incubated this relationship and you never know what's going to come of that. And they might call you and need advice about something. And I mean, it really does. I think that lesson, it's a great Make Me Smart answer because it is something you can only realize by, like, just adulting, growing up.
Right.
Being around for
exactly
a while.
That's exactly right.
And it's true.
There you go.
Tell us your answer to the Make Me Smart question, which once again is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. One thing I thought I knew and was wrong about was that all babies are cute. But I would like to point out that a spider sack hatched recently on the window.
What?
Like the outside of the window right next to my desk here. And
what
I just keep looking at it.
What kind of mind do you have that you go from all babies
right
are cute to spider sacks?
Because there is like a pile of spider babies right there. And it's really distracted me the whole show. I thought I'd done a great job.
I have something
until
I have to say.
I couldn't take it anymore.
It goes like this. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Utro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez, although I can't verify that because I can't see through these lights that Ben Hethcote, our video dude, has put in my face. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
And Ben Hethcote is our video producer. The executive director of On Demand is Tara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
There we go.
I tried to wait till the real end of the pod, live.
Okay.
I can't with them. Should I kill it with fire? Like,
yes.
What do I do?
Stomp on it. What? Take a
I
shoe.
I can't stomp on it. It's like stuck to the window, and it's 1,000 or more baby spiders.
They're tiny, though.
And if I whack it, they're going to crawl onto the, get a hose?
Like, get some Windex and just spritz it on them and then just wipe it off.
Oh, Jesus God.
What? All right, put some gardening gloves on, then spritz some Windex on them, then wipe it off.
It is true. I tell my son all the time. I recently taught him to clean the bathroom, which I thought was a high-level parenting moment. Yeah. And I was like, listen, dude, you can do anything in life as long as you got yellow rubber gloves on.
That's right.